Welcome to Access to Perspectives Conversations, the podcast for bridging academic landscapes. At Access to Perspectives, we provide novel insights into the communication and management of research. Our goal is to equip researchers around the world with the skills and enthusiasm they need to pursue a successful career. You will get insights around the topics of scholarly reading, writing and publishing, career development, project management and research integrity, all embedded into open science practices. Learn more about our work at accesstoperspectives.org.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. I'm very happy to welcome Wendy Patterson from the Beilstein Institute, based here in Germany, where I'm also located. A warm welcome, Wendy. I'm glad you're here with us. Thanks for joining.
Yeah. Hi, Joe. Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me on the show.
And to get our conversation started, how about you share a little bit about your background and then also your current position, what you're doing at the Beilstein Institute, and of course, a little overview of the Beilstein Institute is in charge of in servicing the scholarly community.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, so my name is Wendy Patterson, and I actually come with a research background. So I did my PhD in physics, specifically in optics, but then I went through different research phases. I worked in material science, eventually in chemistry, and worked very multidisciplinary. I did some postdocs as well in different areas of chemistry and material science, but basically frustrated with the system, let's just say, I decided that I wanted to do something to better the system instead of just complaining about it all the time. I saw an ad for the Beilstein Institute.
Yeah. Just to clarify, for when we talk about the system, you mean academia at large or anything particularly in it?
Yeah, generally academia, and for one, the pressure to publish any and everything. This was very frustrating for me as a young scientist, coming naively into the field, thinking that it's about working for the better good and working for to better the world, and to do and just to exercise my desire to do science and to think creatively. And I felt that this was not able to happen in the current system. Creativity is not really what is wanted. This is, what you need to be able to do is to get grants and to publish in specific journals. And this was unfortunately not, this isn't what they tell you as an undergraduate. You learn this along the way. And this kind of system can be frustrating. If you don't fit into this mold of also the kind of stereotypical A-type personality that, then sometimes you get pushed out of the system. And yeah, it can be frustrating. So
because incentives and opportunities to advance the career, but isn't it that most if not all research institutions also have a mandate and a purpose to fulfill, as often self-described, to serve society, to accumulate knowledge, to allow the employed researchers and students to contribute to knowledge acquisition For the eventual purpose? So I'm wondering, where is the crack as we blame the system being part of it? And I just want to support your sentiment, because that's also what I've experienced myself in academia, especially as a PhD student, but also what I see and observe and hear from PhD students that I give workshops to, and also senior level researchers that in the first year, they're still very much excited. They want to cure diseases. They want to save the world. Mostly third and fourth year, towards the end of the PhD, they're all exhausted. They're pressed for time. They're insecure and ashamed. Oh, I don't have enough results to show. And then the publication pressure in the neck. So where did it go wrong? Like, because it sounds as if everybody's trying to achieve the same thing, but yeah, it's not for you to answer. I'm just putting it out there.
Yeah, I mean, there's the pressure to publish, which feeds into the pressure to get big grants, which feeds into the pressure for departments to perform, at the university, which feeds into universities having to perform to get onto these university rankings because they want the students and they need to keep their enrollment up. So I think these are some of the reasons and some of the triggers that lead to this, or that could be leading to this
But I think it's fair to say
environment.
that that's contributing to the dilemma, because rankings are also known to be not unfair or to not be reasonable in the first place. You can't compare one university to the other because they have whole different scopes, regional specificities, whatnot. So it's just not fair to compare. And yet there's a need for some assessment for the students and also those who set up assessments, you know.
I don't think anybody, or none of the people in my network, we don't talk about eliminating metrics or assessment. It's just about thinking about which ones are maybe more useful, and also not putting so much pressure on one particular metric or one particular list of or ranking. Yeah, in the end, nothing replaces reading an article or looking at the broad portfolio of a university as a whole. I mean, this work has to be done. And trying to simplify it with lists and rankings, I think this is kind of what's led us, or it's contributed to the situation that we know exists.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for that sidetrack. But back to your career. So now, in trying to find a place to change the system to the better and course correct, how does the Boston Institute allow you to do that?
Yeah, so I was kind of looking for a home, somewhere where I felt more comfortable, that my where my vision of how I want to live my life fits better with my work. And so I started looking into, let's say, alternatives to the typical academia, typical career in academia. One path I found was, or that was suggested to me, was to look into journals. But of course, coming from my bad experience, or not so great experience with journals, I had only known up to that point kind of commercial. I knew some society journals, but I didn't think that that would be an option for me. But then I stumbled across the Bauxstein Institute. And at the time, there was some open positions for on their editorial team, for the Bauxstein journals. So that's how I came to the Bauxstein Institute. Since then, I have I'm so I began working with the journals, and now I'm the scientific director of the Bauxstein Institute. So today we are a true charitable foundation. So we receive no external funding whatsoever, and we're self-sustained, and we only give back to the community. So we don't charge any fees for any of the projects that we support. And we do all of this through our long-term sustainable projects that we 100% financially support. And like I said, we try to remove all the financial barriers as much as we can into participating into all of our projects. And we also believe that our mission can be best accomplished by supporting open science principles. And these are weaved into all of our different projects. I can tell you about some of our projects or how we do this, if that's of interest. But
Of
that's our
course.
philosophy, first of all, behind the Bauxstein Institute.
So the Boston Institute exists since, as said on your website, 1951. That's quite a track record. Established by the Max Planck Society, which is an association of research institutes or society of research institutes, I think 80 plus. Some are in other countries, Italy, China, I think one or two others. Most in Germany. So is there still affiliation with the Max Planck Society, or is it fully independent?
No, this was the founding of our institute, and since then we have had we've gone through various phases of maintaining our foundation or maintaining our institute. We've had different phases in the past where it was different business forms, and at some point we had enough assets that we could actually convert ourselves into a true of a charitable foundation. And this was important to be able to protect the work that we do to make sure that it you know the kind of work that we do or this resources that we have are not used commercially, but they are for the better good of the public. So that was an important step, was to be able to have enough assets to found a charitable foundation so that we can work the way we do now, which is yeah, reducing barriers.
I was just curious to hear coming from a Max Planck where I did my PhD myself. So it was like one big family eventually. Okay, so talking about open science, thinking about how the UNESCO open science recommendation defines it for a globally inclusive community encompassing infrastructure, communication as in open science, open data, and so on and so forth. But also, okay, there's these four categories, infrastructure, open communication, stakeholder engagement, and then also engaging other knowledge systems, primarily indigenous knowledge, but also traditional knowledge. But then from how I grew up with open science principles, it's more looking towards open access, open data. I think we both agree that it's more important than openness, fairness in data, like findable accessibility, interoperability, and reusability. Because unless fair is given, the point of opening or making the data openly accessible just makes sense because then it's not reusable and what's the point in sharing?
You
So
can make the
some.
buffet free, but if you don't give someone the fork and knife to eat at the buffet, then yeah,
That's
they're
a hot
not
mess.
going to be sustained.
I
Yeah,
think this is all
absolutely.
right. Thank you. But so yeah, I mean, as nice as it sounds, it's also challenging for researchers to think about opening their their lab notebooks and other office doors or whatever to the public. But
Absolutely.
so what are the aspects of open science that the Bajan Institute facilitates?
Yeah, so we've actually started several decades ago on our mission to support open science. Yeah, let's start with open standards. So we've been working with the community for almost 2 decades on standards for glycomics and enzymology. So we have two standards, Strenda and Mirage. They're almost 2 decades old. And this is something that we facilitate and we financially support. And the stakeholders are all from different parts of the community. And these are very important in developing guidelines that we continuously with them keep updated and also developing tools. So that's also one way we support open data, for example, is the corresponding database for Strenda, which is StrendaDB. Yeah, that's one way we support open data, but we are also supporting open data in our journals, which I'll also talk a little bit about maybe as a separate point. And yeah, and in most recent developments, we're also looking to support open source software and community-led open infrastructure is a new area that we're looking to support. And specifically open digital infrastructure for chemistry. So we're working with the if the word won't mean anything to you if you're not into chemistry, but the INCI project, it's an open digital standard to digitize chemical structures, which are very, very important for chemists. You know, they read structures, not words. And we need these machine readable, and that's what we're working on with the INCI project. We're also
Well,
working with IUPAC on different projects to get very important data sets digitized, and also just working on very basic, so the plumbing, the infrastructure behind the exchange of information behind the scenes. So there's a lot of things that need to happen behind the scenes, and this needs maintenance, just like plumbing does. And so plenty of people use roads and plumbing, but you have to maintain it, right? And that's also what we're looking to do, is work on these things that happen kind of behind the scenes that is sometimes difficult to get funding for, because no one feels really responsible for it. But these are the kind of projects that we are also looking to fund as open infrastructure. You also mentioned communication. So we support the direct communication of research results with, we host symposia in all areas of the chemical sciences and beyond. And we've been doing this since, I think 1988 was the first one, but a long time. We've been supporting the open communication of research in this way. We have a webinar series, the Bechstein Talks, and but two of our open science projects where we invest most of our resources and definitely most of our energy are Diamond Open Access Journals and the related preprint server, Bechstein Archives. And yeah, happy to talk more about Diamond Open
Yes,
Access or
I
go down this
know.
path if that's
Yeah.
interesting.
This
But
is
those
very
are
much
kind of our
interesting.
general portfolio.
Well, that's a big portfolio to have as a foundation with well, it might help that you have a discipline focus on chemistry, but also related subjects, is it? Like where there's an intersection to other disciplines like biochemistry or physical chemistry.
Right.
It brings fears, moments of fears also back to my memory. Like chemistry was not my favorite topic in school or at uni, but I fought my way through it. And
But it's not for
also,
most people, and that's why we got to work on communication, because it is fun and it is interesting. It's about
it is. Like
communicating it.
I had my moments of, oh my God, it's actually logical. And like once you get your brain around these tiny molecules, it actually has such cool, other than things exploding in the lab, but which can be fun and exciting to watch, but then to actually understand what's happening is like when you get to that point. But it's like with math, it's just taken me so long to get to such a point, like, and then repetitively so. But yeah, chemistry definitely needs better promotion, and I'm glad that the Bechstein Institute and you and the team are working on that and continuously improving. But I know, since you mentioned Diamond Open Access, that that's a matter of heart for both of us. Can we just have a quick definition of diamond? Because that doesn't seem to be in everybody's awareness. Is it that, I mean, let me just start and then you fill in. So Diamond Open Access can be, or is a form of publishing, open access, so accessible to the public, where the public does not pay, obviously. I think that's the definition of open access in the first place. But so neither the reader, an internet user, pays to read the whole article and associated materials like methodology or and or data, nor the author who's done the research and then compiled the information into a research article, prepared the data sets and then submitted for publishing, has to pay extra beyond what they've already invested in work time. So because we both know, and probably most of our listeners are aware, that there's costs implied, these costs can be carried or put across several other shoulders other than those two stakeholders. And who these shoulders or pots of money come from is, like, can either be funders, like research funders, institutions, the host institution where the research was done in the first place, where the dedicated budget beyond the research budget, but then explicitly not paying for APCs to a certain, it's already getting complicated.
It
Do we
is,
have a
yeah, and
better?
I think as soon as you move to the, so we all understand open access. I think no one really has a, there's really no arguments what open access is. The readers need to have free
We need
access to
internet,
this.
right? So based on
Yeah,
the internet,
exactly. You can
you
download, you can read the article, and you don't have to pay anything. You don't have to log in or give your data.
access.
this is free to read. I think
Or
the
paywall.
issue comes with
Is
who pays for this? Because yeah, like you said, we're in agreement that it costs something. So then who is paying for these costs? And that's, I guess for me, I don't like to say this is the definition of diamond. I can only describe what we
Yeah.
do, what our model is,
Yeah,
and we
maybe
give it a
that's
diamond
easier.
label because you need this label to talk to people, right? But I always, when you know, if we make a promotional flyer or we talk about it at a conference, I always give more words. I don't just say diamond open access because it can mean different things, and I also think that's okay. We're figuring this out. We're navigating it, you know.
Also, as long as we don't pay one entity just for the purpose of, well, I think it's usually a mixed pot of money. And then, or pre-dedicated money for, yes, we pay for publishing and we know who's getting paid for what kind of work and processing the publishing.
Yes, transparency is a word that comes up a lot when we're talking about these different ways to define the business models, and I think that's essential to know what is being paid to publish this information and who is paying it and where does that money come from? Is this taxpayer money? Is this is it appropriate
Governmental.
the amount of fees that are being charged? I mean, if a publisher is so efficient that they can really publish in an efficient manner, that's this is less of an issue if then you know, charging 12,000 euros for an article. I think people have less problems with you know, some of the smaller open access publishers than they do with some of the big name publishers who are really you know, charging a lot of money,
Stretching,
but
yeah,
that's a
stretching.
different topic, getting off a diamond. But
Yeah, I think it really gets easier if we look at diamond on a use case scenario. So if an institution has their own journal, which they either subsidize through their own budget, can that be diamond then? Or is it
right,
self?
and I think I at least. From my perspective, from someone who's been publishing or an institute that's been publishing Diamond Open Access for decades, I don't mind that other people use the definition in a slightly different way. I think we're trying to figure out who are like-minded and who's who has the best interest of the publisher or have the best interest of the public in mind and it's a term that we use so that we can come together and work together and know who we want to work with.
But
But
with
yeah,
the
but for us, it's.
I'm sorry, no, just to clarify. So what we want to achieve through putting a label like Diamond Open Access to make clear that we do not want the audience, like the readers have to pay, nor the submitting authors, because we live in a globalized scholarly ecosystem landscape, and the researchers have unevenly distributed budgets available, so it wouldn't be fair to charge a certain amount to any who's submitting. It's already getting complicated, but now with the Bystein open diamond open access way.
Yeah, that's we also to absolutely agree with the sentiment that everyone should have equal access to read and publish. But I think there's but there's also the libraries, there's also the funders, there's also you know, right now with we also work to, at least with the model that we're using, we also want to eliminate the burden for also librarians. They need time to engage with their researchers instead of engaging in contract negotiations. This is a lot of time that they're spending in the last years with these contract negotiations, and less time to library. And I
Is
think this
what
is a
they,
pity too. They've turned into, or they now they have to have skills in legal skills, and this is not in their job description, to be honest. And this is also what we're working to reduce this barrier for the librarians. So with the kind of model we have, there's nothing to negotiate. We take care of this. And that's how we define for us Diamond Open Access, that there are no fees, there never were, there never will be whatsoever. That's for readers. for authors, for universities, for librarians, and for funders. Funders need, in my opinion, they focus on funding research. Researchers need to publish and communicate their research, but I think there are existing models that can cover a lot of this publication process, and that's we're one of them. We're one of many of models that can do this.
Yeah. Do you want to go into the production process of the two Diamond Open Access journals that you host?
Sure. What do you mean,
As
more
in,
specifically, with the
like, because
production
you mentioned
process?
you also have an in-house preprint repository. So what's the workflow from submission to publication? And how, yeah, with regards to, okay, what's the Diamond approach in the process? And what are the checkpoints, I think?
I mean, we basically function like every other, let's say, journal or publisher. I mean, we're not a publisher, but we function, the journals function as if they're going through a regular process of any other journal. The process itself is not any different. We did add a preprint server onto our journal platform. And this came from the authors expressed a desire to have the ability to share their work earlier. And because quality publishing takes time, to meet this need, this was something that we agreed with our researchers that was something beneficial for them. And about a third, about I think the last statistics were about a third or 25% of our authors who are eligible to publish a preprint do. So they use this function, but otherwise that's really the only different step. I mean, of course, at the end there's no payment and there's no bill that arrives at their in their post box, but otherwise our process is very similar to other quality journals. It goes through a peer review process. We have, of course, first internal checks. We check for plagiarism and copyright issues and some basic checks. The articles then go to our associate editors, who are our board members, and they handle the peer review. And these are typically university professors or researchers that are actively working in the field. We feel like that's very important. The scholar-led aspect, I think, is also very important to maintain. There's a time and place for professional editors in certain fields, but at least for chemistry, we stand behind the statement that we feel that the peer review process needs to be handled by an editor who's actively doing research in this sub-discipline that they're editing. So the associate editors then handle the article. They make the decision to publish or reject, and then we have our staff here internally, which work on the production of the article, which is done at exactly the same professional level as any other journal article. We work on dissemination as well. We have JATS HTML, JATS XML. We have all of the technical bells and whistles that all of the other publishers have, and our website is also meets and exceeds the standards of other publishers as well. So that's our typical process.
Cool. Great.
But not so different than any other journal.
Yeah, it sounds quite familiar. And it's also good, I think, for many who are listening, to just see or hear the workflow from can I say publisher's perspective, even though it's like it's, the Russian Institute is clearly more than a publisher.
It's
The processing workflow. So
and we
that.
feel that it's and I think another aspect that's also important that sometimes is overlooked. So our staff, they're also every one of our staff, everyone who touches the article also has previously done research in the broad area that they are working with. They've done PhDs, they've done postdocs, they have experience too, and I think that's also important. The work is not outsourced. Not that outsourcing is always bad, but they are employees and they receive good benefits. They're paid well, they have a good working environment, and I think that's also an aspect that that we shouldn't that yeah, I think this aspect sometimes isn't emphasized enough, that the people actually working, they have to be paid. Everything is can't just be volunteer labor, otherwise the whole system collapses.
Yeah, also to show quality that you have people who are actually comfortable in their position and the task they're doing, to not to have to stress about money constraints or pressure points by their employer to meet a certain, I
To
don't
meet
know.
some targets. This is that's the benefit, and that's also why we think that this kind of model, publishing with a nonprofit, is also important, because we we don't have this pressure to publish. We don't have to meet shareholder demands. We don't have to meet some profit goals. We're here to publish quality, and that's really our KPI, which, yeah, I don't necessarily like this
Performance
this
indicator.
acronym, but definitely not in context of our work. But yeah, our KPI is to produce quality research and to publish it, to publish quality research. And
I think it's important to have such indicators for quality and performance in if it's in within limits that are humanly acceptable and not only acceptable but comfortable. Where we don't turn ourselves into robots, as we discussed ahead of the recording.
And they don't provide negative incentives, such as you need to have so many publications per month, so that we have enough profit. I think that's a bad incentive, especially for the Nonprofit Act of Research. It just doesn't fit together well, in my opinion.
So I'm wondering how, like, what's the processing capacity at the moment for the two journals that you're hosting? Should I highlight it in Diamond Open Access Journals just to shine a light on that aspect again? And we want to see more of that. And thanks for setting the example. How's the submission rate compared to the editorial team's capacity to process? Because that sometimes is an in-house pressure point, which often leads to delays in processing times, which are unintended, but just happen to be because of the high throughput that some publishers are dealing with.
No, that's a good point to bring up, a good question to ask, especially when you have a small journal, a small team. This can be important. You can get a lot of submissions at once, and then the authors are disappointed that their article doesn't get processed quickly enough. Whereas if you're a large journal, you can spread this out in a different way. But how we handle it is that, so I mentioned we have lots of different projects, we work in different areas, and we try to make our projects a bit flexible. So so the people who work on the journals are also working on other projects too, right? So we have a bit of a balance there. We can spend more time on the journals or more time on our other projects, as the need comes. But yeah, this is an issue. I think it's more of an issue for an organization that doesn't have a broad portfolio of other projects, but for us, this is not so much an issue. But I would say that we and not only us, but other Diamond Open Access journals that I work with, we would all actually like to have more submissions. So one question that comes often is, what about scale? Diamond Open Access, scale, scale, scale. I always hear this question, or this issue. At least all the Diamond App Open Access journals that I'm associated with, I'm also on another associated with another group, the Free Journal Network, where 80 to 90 Diamond Open Access journals, and we all say the same thing. We would actually like to have more submissions. We have more capacity, and we would, I think, at least most of them in this network would probably say easily we could probably double our capacity. But the issue is that unfortunately, researchers and librarians and funders, they're not taking advantage of the existing Diamond Open Access venues as well as they could. This, of course, has some reasons. We talked at the beginning about incentives, research, assessment, and incentives there. Our journals are qu high quality, and we stand behind the quality of our journals. But we still have to contend with issues or questions from potential authors about the journal impact factor, for example. This question comes up often. And for some of them, we don't meet their expectations in this sense. And this is tends to be an issue for all of us in this Diamond Open Access area, especially in the STEM areas, less so in math, but in other STEM areas. We all have this issue that we would like to publish more, but the authors are sometimes turned off by some of these metrics that are being used inappropriately to judge quality.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. And it's also as a trainer, I decided to ignore the topic altogether unless it's brought to me. And then I refer researchers back to, okay, look up what that impact factor actually does. And you can also, it's a fun fact, the original article written by Eugene Garfield, who came up with the impact factor, is still behind a paywall at Science. It is like
No.
the Science main journal. And you would think after more than 50 years it would be liberated as such, but there's a free copy available, which I'm happy to share also to this podcast. And I refer people to that article where it's not explicitly said, but Eugene Garfield goes around saying, oh, it's actually not a good metrics, not, without using these exact words, but highlighting the flaws and asking readers to be cautious in applying the impact factor for ranking purposes explicitly, because, and then a few years later, or just a decade ago, there was another article by him where he sort of says, yes, it has flaws, but it's the best we have at the moment. I think there was still an era where criticism had come up, but it wasn't as obvious that it's so detrimental and so counterproductive for what you're trying to achieve as a scholarly community. So we're still defensive of it, saying, oh, it's the best we have, so deal with it. But I think like all the open science advocates that I know of, yourself including and me and many others we often engage with, just know that it's not made for the purpose that it's being useful for. And I think the other issue that researchers have, like I know that in biology, like people would pride themselves, oh, I landed a paper in, of course, Nature, but also Cell, this and that. So a certain, like there's all cultural prestige kind of culture around publishing in certain journals, which is tied to the impact factor, but also there was also this article, which I often give as a reading exercise to participants in my scholarly publishing courses, was issued in 2016 by the British newspaper, again, The Guardian, where they focus on the rise of the Elsevier Empire and basically recapping how that came to power. And yeah. And now there's been follow-up articles since then, basically.
I think that was a good one. I think that's, I read this one probably once a year. I go back to it and read
Right?
it, and you're like, and it just becomes more and more true every time you read it and the more you
Exactly.
learn.
Yeah.
Yeah,
How
I think that
much
was a.
commercial publishers are killing societies eventually, like, or not killing, but it's like harming dreadfully.
Yeah, I mean, there's, yeah, the issue of this big, the big buyout that is happening, has been happening. They're buying the smaller journals, and the society publishers are being bought up and
Yeah,
plucked into the
and
top five. Yeah, this is
but also the image never, like I can't get rid of that image in my head where they describe how, what's his name, the founder of Elsevier. Well, I'll report back later, so it will be in the comment section of the podcast, the show notes. So how he invited highly reputable researchers to cruise on the Mediterranean, and poured out alcohol and food and whatnot, and made them sign contracts to tie themselves to only publish in his journals. And the onset was actually like a 20-something guy. I have another person in my head who had a similar career ambition. Like, how can I get rich the quickest way possible? And looked at the scholarly publishing, you wouldn't call it industry at the time, but the university publishers, like, oh, that's a bit boring. You can do better than that. There's no color imaging and whatnot you can do, fancy pens. And of course, that attracts people. Of course, researchers would like to have their results showcased in all kinds of fancy manners to also for the purpose of science communication. So there's nothing wrong with that. So I think, yeah. So, but that really got me, like, and never left me with the, oh my God, so much wrong in the system. But, like, and the impact factor is like the hook for everything, seems like. But this is also how it evolved, or how one thing led to the other, and now we're stuck here. Yeah, it's interesting. But then once researchers and early career researchers get a glimpse of the happenings in the past and why things are the way they are today and what options they have, I think it's easy to shift the paradigm. Well, relatively speaking, of course, we might need to reach the masses, but how do we get there?
The issue is, so when we also work on ad, we advocate also for a better, more sustainable, fairer system. And when we go and we talk to researchers, we talk to our editors, we are always gauging, how they react to this topic. It's not that they don't know that it exists. They know that they know what the journal impact is. Journal impact factor is how it's calculated. They know about these rankings, but they their response is always they're trapped in the system. So it's a bit of a Stockholm syndrome, right? They're trapped, and they just want to get by, and they want to build their careers, and that's what they have to do. So for them, I don't think they care so much what the system is. They just need to get through
Get
it,
through it,
right? So for them, I don't. At least I don't think they're the really the right target. They just want to do their research, and they're having to do all these things to
I
do their
know,
research,
yeah. And
right?
that's what I try to accomplish as a trainer is exactly to empower them with alternatives because there are alternatives. And then I think it's still an opportunity to raise certain points on how things evolved into the current status, to question it again and to not, because I've seen too many people, as well as my peers, and when I graduated, like through my PhD, who just gave in to, okay, that's what it is. Well, then let me see how I get through and make my career and sustain my family. If there's so many of us who just give in to the status quo, nothing will ever change. And we have seen so little change in the past 2 decades, one, but then also a lot of change on the, yeah. So I feel like empowerment comes with knowing your options. This is my kind of approach now. Know your options and question the status quo, not to your, on your risking your own career, but there's always more than one option that you have at your fingertips.
I agree. And to extend beyond science, beyond scholarly communication, but I think also related, I mean, when people asked on their deathbed what regret do they have, it's the first one is usually something to the extent of, I wish I'd been true to myself, and I wish I had not lived my life for others, right? And I think this is being in the system and being trapped in the system, you're living your life for others and not for the sake of what compels you and motivates you in life. And to take a stand here, I think this is a very critical time in a researcher's lifespan, is to look at this moment when they start publishing, and say, is this really what I want, or am I doing this because of others? I want to please others. I want to I think that's, and it's difficult to break away from the norm. It is.
It is, but it shouldn't be so. And that's why, like, I'm actually getting goosebumps because it's bringing us back to the beginning of the conversation where you shared, like, why you chose to shift games, like trying to serve academia instead of serving it, or serving it differently, and in terms of trying to change it to the better again. Because I, like in my trainings, like now we have the UNESCO Open Science Recommendation, we have the Open Science Principles, all of which postulate come with principles and values, as UNESCO now also postulated. And then I nowadays start with referring to the Human Rights Declaration, Article 27, which
Yes.
explicitly says that every human being on this planet has a right to engage in scientific achievements and have, also have their knowledge and their participation thereof protected. And this is what open science is calling for. At the end of the day, we're talking about good scientific practice and human values. And the system, as you said in the beginning, is not allowing to do that today. So, yeah, so basically the whole podcast, but especially also this episode, is about okay, there are a few things we can tweak and twingle to allow the system to serve its purpose again. And each of us can play their part. And the Bachelor Institute certainly does a lot to on their yeah, on your capacity with your activities.
Yeah, and in that sense, I should say that we're not, our goal here is not to publish all of chemistry. That's not what we're here, but we're here to set an example to show about how things could be and to show that there is a model, there is a way. And it doesn't mean that all chemistry needs to be published this way, but there are options. And there are options for people who do decide, you know, this other route is not for me. Then that's what we're here for.
Sure.
Yeah,
So,
that's,
for other chemistry scholars and researchers in particular out there, like any researcher from any part of the world can submit their articles to any of the two journals? Or so
Yes,
you have
yeah,
no
it's
reason.
absolutely no restrictions whatsoever.
Does it your focus is organic chemistry and
And
nanotechnology?
nanotechnology, yeah. That's a, those are our current two focuses, because that's where our in-house expertise is. So the like I said, I think that it's very important that those who work on the journal production also have a background in the area in which we're publishing, and that's where our current background is around nanotechnology and organic chemistry. Yeah, but that could also change with time, but that's why we currently focus on these areas.
Makes sense to have exp well to offer venues where you actually have in-house expertise. So yeah, and then like for the in the broader chemistry community, there's preprint repository to like ChemArchive as well. There's scholarly society publishers like the American Chemical Association,
American
oh.
Chemical Society, ACS.
Society, and then the Royal
Society
Chemical
of Chemistry, yeah, RSC.
Society, and then a few others. So you're one strong of several other players in the discipline of chemistry and broader STEM, part of broader STEM. And I just wanted to highlight again, I showed this also to you, like where we've collected open science resources, and it started off with a chemist or with a as well chemistry, but a discipline specific approach. We will link this also to the show notes or the affiliated blog post comes with the release of this episode, where we have a collection of chemistry related and chemistry focused open science resources. So all the chemistry people, you're welcome to tap into that resource and approach the Bachelor Institute's contact details, and maybe we can also well you, we usually also put your LinkedIn and the contact details that you chose to be contacted through in the show notes so that people who would want to know more can reach you or we can refer to you any inquiries that come in.
Absolutely. Yeah. Be happy to talk with anybody in the community has ideas about how we can, yeah, reach our mission or to reach their particular group or yeah, to do a better job at helping researchers communicate. Yeah.
Maybe as a last word, so what is on your roadmap for this year or the coming 1 or 2 years? What's next in the virtual institute? Are you shifting gears to a new branch of activities, or are you looking to
Yeah, we're working. Yeah, I can maybe give you a little bit of an overview. So I gave in the beginning a little bit of an overview of our current projects, but one emphasis in the next years is going to be, so with the journals, we want to move the journals from not just open access but to open science. So we'll be incorporating more open data and all the other open science principles into the journal more over the next years. Data is right now our focus. It's a tough one, but we're working on it with together with the community on some different pilot projects. So that'll be an emphasis. And we're going to be working more to support so basic infrastructure too, just generally. And we're also working on some educational projects as well, trying to help younger researchers fulfill some unmet needs that they may have right now. And we also support general outreach as well. We support chemistry museums and outreach in this sense as well. I would like to do more in that aspect. I'd love to cover the whole wheel of everything in open science, but we do what we can, especially within or in terms of what's most important in chemistry and communication of chemistry, which tends to be journals and conferences. So that's really where our focus is. But we're always looking for ways to support others all along this open science wheel. So, yeah, but open data will be our next focus over the next 2 years, and machine readable chemical information.
Cool. Thank you so much. And I'm looking forward to see machine readable chemical formulas popping up here and there.
Yeah, or hopefully you won't see them. That's the point. They should work in the background. So hopefully you don't have to see them, but you'll have access to them.
Okay. I was gonna add, the more we mentioned the word chemistry, I started to miss those, but fine. But okay. Thank you so
Yeah, thank
much.
you so much. Yeah, thank you too. This was a great chat, and yeah, always happy to chat with you, Joe.
Thanks. Likewise.
Thanks for joining us to listen to this episode. Do let us know what you think. You can email us or connect with us on our social media channels, which you can find on our website at accesstoperspectives.org. Email us at info@accesstoperspectives.org or book a call to explore how we can support you with your research planning, management, and publishing. Welcome you again soon for our next episode. Until then, have a great time.